Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1023 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser med mig Ronny Berggren och till del 85 i Miserium USAs presidentval 2020. Demokraternas kandidater har lämnat fiaskot i Iowa kvar hos lokalpartiet som nu räknar resultaten för allt vad det är värda, medan kandidaterna själva har åkt vidare till nästa delstat, New Hampshire, där primärval hålls på tisdag den 11 februari. Här följer ett samtal med en republikan strategen och vår återkommande proffsgäst Justin White om den rådande situationen. Varmt välkomna! Ja, i sedvanlig ordning så tänkte jag lite kort inleda med Donald Trump. Och Donald Trump, han höll två tal idag. Dels så talade han på The National Prayer Breakfast i morse. Och han pratade mycket om religionsfrihet, USAs kamp under hans administration för religionsfrihet. Dels ute i världen men också hemma i USA, rätten att be i skolor och liknande. Men han kom också tidigt in på riksrättsprocessen där han då hade blivit friad, och om det så sa han så här.
As everybody knows, my family, our great country, and your president have been put through a terrible ordeal by some very dishonest and corrupt people. They have done everything possible to destroy us, and by so doing, very badly hurt our nation. They know what they are doing is wrong, but they put themselves far ahead of our great country. Weeks ago and again yesterday, courageous Republican politicians and leaders had the wisdom, fortitude, and strength to do what everyone knows was right. I don't like people who use their faith as justification for doing what they know is wrong. Nor do I like people who say, I pray for you, when they know that that's not so. So many people have been hurt, and we can't let that go on. And I'll be discussing that a little bit later at the White House.
Senare på kvällen så höll Trump också ett tal, eller på dagen amerikansk tid då, för några timmar sedan, ett tal specifikt om riksrättsprocessen. Eller ett tal, det var mer en blandning kan man säga, mellan en presskonferens och ett tal. Och där sa Donald Trump så här.
And this is really not a news conference. It's not a speech. It's not anything. It's just we're sort of, it's a celebration because we have something that just worked out. I mean, it worked out. We went through hell unfairly, did nothing wrong. I've done things wrong in my life, I will admit. Not purposely, but I've done things wrong. But this is what the end result is. You can take that home, honey. Maybe we'll frame it. It's the only good headline I've ever had in the Washington Post.
Och det som stod på Washington Post då, det var Trump acquitted, Trump frikänd stod det där. Och ja, det här kommer förmodligen att stärka Trumps möjligheter i valet 2020 och i höst senare. Därför att nu hänger inte det här bagaget över honom längre, utan han är fri från det och han kan fokusera mer på kampanjen. Och det är kombinationen med en stark ekonomi och ja, ändå ganska framgångar för honom. Plus då de här ganska dåliga nyheterna för demokraterna gör att Trump går starkt in nu in i den här valrörelsen. Någon annan slutsats är svår att dra. Och med det sagt så går vi över till min intervju med Justin White och om demokraternas situation i Iowa. Justin White, welcome.
Ah, it's nice to speak with you again, Ronnie.
Yeah, we have had this caucus in Iowa and it was just totally chaos for the Democrats. Do you have any comments?
Well, you know, some things weather better than they appear. It does seem as though Mayor Pete Buttigieg, the speech he gave has tracked pretty well with his, no doubt, internal numbers that he had. And so, you know, it does appear as though he either won or tied. You know, we'll know a little later today or tomorrow, I think, whether because Bernie does seem to be catching up a bit, but not enough to overtake him with any real significance. So either way, Pete Buttigieg, you know, has pulled off something pretty remarkable considering he was the mayor of, by U.S. standards, a small city. Yeah. And has, you know, finished, you know, first in the Iowa caucuses. But what it also proves is that Bernie Sanders' strength is not nearly what anyone thought it was. The notion, when they actually looked at the vote totals, Bernie got no more votes than he got last time in terms of actual people. So the notion that he's got some sort of massive engine doesn't seem to be panning out. Of course, he's raised quite a lot of money. In fact, apparently he's raised $25 million just in the month of January, which is a truly staggering sum for a primary campaign with so many candidates in it. But it is interesting to see that. We're going on to New Hampshire, which is a different model, but I'm sure we'll get into that.
Yeah, but you know, all this, you know, the whole mess about, you know, counting, not votes, but counting, you know, reporting in the results. I mean, that must have been like a catastrophe for the, you know, the local Democratic Party in Iowa.
Absolutely. And there's, you know, admittedly, here we are and now this is the start of the third decade in the 21st century, and there's really no excuse. You know, the reality is that as Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe on MSNBC made the comment that, you know, for 10 years we've had something called Google Sheets and you could just log on and plug the information in directly from your phone or your laptop. It doesn't have to be this difficult. And there's really no excuse for why it took, or is taking, right, because it's still going on, you know, now 3 days later. There really is no excuse.
No, but I can't imagine why would you need, you know, to create your own personal application, mobile application, to, you know, to have this result, you know, in a technological way, when you can use, like you mentioned, Google, and you can use like maybe, you know, some other application that is safe and but always, you know, like tested and, you know, common. Why do you have to build your own application?
Yeah, and when you publish the numbers, you know, naturally any of the local caucus chieftains will have written it down as well, and they'll be able to see if you're telling somebody something that's not right, and then they can just update the spreadsheet. This is not rocket science, frankly.
Exactly, yeah. Do you think there will be any consequences, you know, in the future? Because the candidates, I read somewhere that Biden's team especially were very angry at, you know, the local Democratic Party in Iowa. You know, do you think the candidates will, you know, in four years from this will say, like, we don't trust the Iowa local Democratic Party, so we don't want a caucus there? Do you think that could be a consequence?
Well, to be fair, this isn't the first time people have whispered about that. And, you know, and of course, you know, there's no telling for certain. But what I will say is that 4 years is a very long time. And, you know, it tends to, you know, as there were similar, you know, upset in 2012 for Republicans there with Rick Santorum. But then there was no problem the following 4 years. So there's always a little bit of a tempest in a teapot when things like this happen. But the other reality is Iowa and New Hampshire are very special in that they, although Nevada is reaching into this space as well, they're small states and small matters because their entire purpose is to allow candidates who aren't staggeringly wealthy or truly like world famous to have a chance to run. And most importantly, both Iowa and New Hampshire have gone to both Democrats and Republicans in the last 12 years. So they're also true swing states. So while people might argue that they're not, like right now, there's members of the left who are really mad that Iowa doesn't represent, you know, things that are more similar to a Los Angeles or a New York City, the reality is they're actually quite representational of America as a whole. Mm. And if you want your candidate to be someone that America wants to elect, which should be the goal of a presidential candidate, then you want them before audiences that look like the United States, not your Democratic base, or for that matter, your Republican base, right? Certainly, if the primary was held not in Iowa, but Alabama, you would get a bunch of Republicans who are very Republican picking the most Republican-like candidate, but that candidate may very well lose 40 states. Yeah. You know, it depends. As we saw when Alabama chose Roy Moore for their nominee for U.S. Senate, you know, by the same token, Joaquin Castro may well be able to get elected in a place like San Antonio, Texas, which is a wildly diverse and majority Latino, you know, city. But as evidenced by his 14th place finish in Iowa, he's not exactly someone who's capable of winning over middle America. So I do think it's important that we keep the Iowas and the New Hampshires or something like that in the mix, purple states that have less than 3 or 4 million people. And the truth is there's only about 5 of those states. So if it's not Iowa, I don't really know where they take it since they've already got Nevada and New Hampshire in the mix. I guess theoretically you could, you know, maybe contemplate somewhere like, you know, North Dakota or something, but, you know.
Yeah, but
I don't know.
We need the small states. But, you know, I was thinking that one candidate that really says, I don't need the small states is Michael Bloomberg. And he's, you know, betting all on Super Tuesday and he skipped Iowa. Maybe that was a smart move when, you know, this mess happened in Iowa. Do you think this
Michael Bloomberg is prepared to spend more money than has ever been spent in an entire election by all parties single-handedly, and he can do it out of his checkbook. And, you know, if we want to live in a world where only Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Michael Bloomberg are the presidents of the United States, you know, then sure, you know, we can just, you know, take it to places like California, New York, or Florida, or Texas, you know, who certainly have more advanced technological infrastructures. But, you know, if you don't have $150 million, you might as well not even show up. Hmm. And that will, in my opinion, threaten democracy long term.
Yeah. So it was a mistake on Michael Bloomberg not to compete in Iowa?
I don't think so because of the timing. His campaign is predicated on a collapse of Joe Biden, which seems to be potentially happening. We'll know a lot more next week after New Hampshire.
Yeah.
But fourth place, and you mentioned Biden's vocalization of the Iowa failure, but I think it's a case of I think thou doth protest too much, to quote Shakespeare. You know, the truth is that he finished a distant fourth with almost half the votes of either Mayor Pete or Bernie Sanders, which means that he actually benefited most from the chaos, because if there had been a direct and quick reporting that he finished fourth instead of a question over whether he finished second, third, or fourth, which is kind of what it looked like early on in the evening. You know, nobody thought he won, but it was possible that he, you know, was in a tight pack of 1, 2, 3 where, you know, nobody was really that successful, which has, of course, now been wrong. But he kind of gave a mediocre, you know, success speech, you know, and got out the door to New Hampshire, where versus if it had hit like the bomb, it could have, his campaign could be in dire trouble as opposed to just, you know, difficulty, which is what he's facing now. You know, I think if Biden doesn't finish in the top three in New Hampshire, his campaign may well be on life support. And that's what Mayor Bloomberg is counting on, because he's definitely running in the kind of the Biden lane, if you will, to take on Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and the more left wing members of the party.
Yeah, I have one more question about Iowa, then we're going to go to New Hampshire. But, you know, as far as I understood it, Amy Klobuchar got almost as many votes as Joe Biden, and that must be really good for her, actually.
It is in a relative sense, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's, you know, when you're tying the former vice president, it sounds great until you realize he's in fourth place. So it's kind of a cold comfort, as we would say. That means said, she certainly did better than anyone expected her to do, which is probably enough for her to justify running until at least South Carolina. She'll probably raise enough money to not run a very strong campaign, but to run a competent campaign in both New Hampshire and South Carolina. And I'll tell you who that hurts most is probably a mixture of Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren, of course, being the other female candidate in the race. If she were to drop out, there would only be a single female candidate. That would certainly help Elizabeth Warren considerably, probably worth 3 or 4 points for Elizabeth Warren, that she's not going to get what she desperately needs. And likewise, Amy's politics, Senator Klobuchar's politics, are more akin to Joe Biden. So her presence in the race is also probably hurting Vice President Biden by 3 or 4 points, which, you know, in a multi-candidate field like this is, you know, it can be the difference between finishing second or third or first or second kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I definitely think the fact that she lives to fight another day in New Hampshire is going to hurt both Biden and Warren, which will certainly be to the benefit of both Mayor Pete and Bernie Sanders. So we may be looking at a semi-repeat of Iowa and New Hampshire, but we'll see.
Ja, även om skuggan av Iowa fortfarande hänger kvar så är det ju nu New Hampshire som gäller. Och som sagt, de håller primärval i New Hampshire på tisdag den 11 februari. Och igår, den 5 februari, så höll CNN i ett townhall-möte i New Hampshire där fyra av de demokratiska kandidaterna deltog. Och det var Joe Biden, det var Elizabeth Warren, det var Andrew Yang och det var Tom Steyer. Och på townhall-möten så möter ju kandidaterna inte varandra, det är ingen debatt, utan de besvarar frågor ställda av antingen moderat CNNs moderator eller av en utvald person i publiken, och det var så det gick till, och de hade en timme var, och det innebar att de hade ganska lång tid att ingå i det långa djupa svar, och det är alltid intressant att få se kandidaterna prata lite mer avslappnat, lite mer ingående istället för de här korta, snabba snap-soundbiten som är i debatterna. Och vi kan börja med att spela ett klipp från Elizabeth Warren som fick en fråga om rollen som kvinna i den här kandidaturen.
Jennifer Wallach, student here at St. Anselm College, still undecided. What's your question?
As a woman studying politics here at St. Anselm, I sometimes feel as if I will be at a disadvantage when I enter the workforce, since the majority of people associate politics with men. Do you believe that the men in this race have a better chance of beating Trump solely because of their gender?
I believe they may think so, but they'd be wrong. You know, Jennifer, and let's just talk about this. You're studying this. You're looking at the numbers on it. The world changed in 2016. Once Donald Trump was elected, the world changed. Think about it this way. The day he was sworn in, what happened the very next day? It was the Women's March, the largest protest rally in the history of the world. And I still remember a lot of commentators were saying afterwards, well, yeah, you know, the women really turned out here, and friends of women, also known as men, they really turned out here, but are they really going to be here in a month? And the answer was, yes. Were they really going to be here in 6 months? And the answer was, oh, yeah. Were they still going to be here in a year? And the answer was, you better believe it. Understand this. We took back, we Democrats took back the House of Representatives in 2018 and state houses around this country because of women candidates and women and friends of women who were energized by those candidates. What the data show now is that in competitive elections, women are outperforming men. So here's how I see this. At the end of the day, when people start picking who they want for a president, it's got to be somebody they trust. And it can't just be somebody who looks like what presidents looked like in the past. Sometimes we got to think differently. Remember, in 1960, a lot of folks said, not sure we can do a Catholic because nobody's ever done a Catholic before. We never had a Catholic president before. Or in 2008, a lot of folks said, we can't have an African-American nominee because we've never had an African-American president before. But our party is better than that, and we proved that our country is better than that. 2020, we can and should have a woman for president.
Och här är ett klipp med Joe Biden som var väldigt ingående. Han fick en fråga om han hade något råd att ge för folk som stammar. Och Joe Biden har ju själv haft problem när jag som stammar, med stamning när han var yngre. Och han besvarade det så här ganska ingående.
Vice President Biden, what advice would you give a college student who has struggled with stuttering since he was a young child?
You know, stuttering, you think about it, is the only handicap that people still laugh about, that still humiliate people about, and they don't even mean to. When I was a kid, I talk like that, and some of you smile. If I said to you when I was a kid I had a cleft palate and people made fun of me, or I had a withered arm, no one would smile. It's a debilitating situation. I deal with about 15 stutterers I keep in contact with all the time. I met with a young man, I will not name him, day before yesterday. Took him in after my staff got upset because we did a town meeting like this, and I met him. I could tell when I met him, and you can tell too, Reverend, you see the face, you can see the anxiety in their faces. And he looked at me, he said, ha, ha, ha. And I said, why don't you and I go back in the green room here, and I'll show you how I write my speeches. Did you see the movie The King's Speech? Well, you should see it if you haven't. What The King's Speech was all about is a man with enormous courage standing up in the middle of the beginning of war, speaking to his countrymen and saying he needed help. The guy who actually helped him write that speech knew how I do my speeches, how I mark up my speeches. I go through so that I make sure that I try to get a circumstance where I don't have to go quickly. And what happens is that if you notice, most people who, in fact, are Mel Tillerson, great singer, never stutters, but has difficulty speaking, difficulty talking, stutters badly. A lot of people are like that. And we can overcome it. And the point I make to these young people that I still work with is that, in fact, it's critically important for them not to judge themselves by their speech, that not let that define them. And I get in the phone and I work. And the hardest thing to do is to talk on the telephone, or to read out loud, to look at a paper and have to read something. And so I work with these students. And when I was up at Syracuse University, I worked with the School of Speech Pathology as a student. I'm not a professional, but as a law student, I would spend time with him. There was a young man whose first name was Bruce from a town that starts with B. I don't want to identify him without his permission. He's doing very well now, working for IBM. But this is a guy who and he can speak now. But here's what's happening. It's still halting. And so what I say to anybody out there and any of the people you work with, young people who stutter, I'll give you my phone number, not a joke, and they can call me. I'll give you a private number because it's really important they know. They know. They want to say, you really did stutter? And I still occasionally, when I find myself really tired, catch myself saying something like that. It has nothing to do with your intelligence quotient. It has nothing to do with your intellectual makeup. It has something to do with going back a long time relating to, I think part of it is confidence and how you were, what circumstance you faced. I know I'm talking too long about this, but I feel desperately, I feel strongly about this.
Och Andrew Yang, han var ganska rolig. Han fick ju fråga om Donald Trump och sa så här.
Deborah Konopka is here. She is a network operations technician from Amherst. She says she is supporting Senator Sanders. Deborah.
Hello, Mr. Yang. Do you feel that you are the best equipped candidate to beat President Trump on the debate stage and why?
Thank you for this question. I love it so much because the number one criteria that Democratic primary voters have for the nominee is what? Beat Donald Trump. That's right. And here's why I am the best person to beat Donald Trump in the general election. So I'm a numbers guy in New Hampshire, and people who are betting their hard-earned money on these head-to-head matchups have me as the heaviest betting favorite against Donald Trump in the general election. I'm the 3-2 favorite. Everyone else, including Bernie, is at best even money. So why is it that people think I'm the best, toughest matchup? Because 18% of college Republicans said they would choose me over Donald Trump in the general election. Because 10% of New Hampshire Trump voters in one poll said that they would choose me over Trump in the general election. You know who has already figured out that I'm his toughest matchup? Donald Trump. I am the only candidate in the field he has not tweeted a word about. And he has not tweeted a word about me for two reasons. Number one, he knows I'm better at the internet than he is. And number two, his most potent attacks are that you're a corrupt DC politician and none of this stuff works on me. One of his advisors was quoted in a meeting that was caught on film saying the candidate they're most worried about is Andrew Yang. And as more Democrats realize that I am the candidate that's best situated to defeat Donald Trump soundly in the general election, the stronger this campaign will grow and the more likely I become the nominee.
Och Tom Steyer, han pratade om klimatet och han sa...
Mr. Steyer, you mentioned your time in business. You made your $1.6 billion in part in investing in coal, oil, and gas. Now you say, as you did again here, climate crisis, that's your number one priority. What was your aha moment? When did you say, I'm going to step away from my company and I'm going to work to help solve this crisis?
Well, let me say this. Our company invested in every part of the American economy, including oil and gas and coal. And we did it. We didn't do much of it in terms of the percentage of the economy, but we definitely did it. And I realized as we were doing it, I basically thought the American government works. If there's a big problem, the American government will solve it. And somewhere around 14 or 15 years ago, I thought, this doesn't seem to be working. There's this huge unintended consequence of having a fossil fuel economy, which is climate change. And I started to do whatever I could to try and solve this problem then. And what did that look like? To me, I still thought it wasn't a government problem. I started to back research, technology research, thinking, the problem is we don't have good enough clean energy. I'll invest in research in universities so they can come up with better technologies. And I invested in bipartisan studies to prove that solving this would not only solve a problem, but would make us, all the things I said, better employed, healthier, more just. Neither of those things mattered a bit. So what I finally decided was, this is a political problem. I divested, I walked away from my company, I took the giving pledge, and for 12 years, I have been fighting this fight politically. Because I realized the real problem here is that it's not that people don't know the answer, it's that they'd rather make money for the next 2 or 3 years, and they own the Congress. There's never been a congressional climate bill, ever. 30 years. What I'm asking Americans to do, what I've been saying for the last 12 years, is no one got into this to do a bad thing. No one knew that we were causing climate change, but now we do. So I'm asking people to do exactly what I did, which was say, okay, let's solve the problem. We have information, we know it. Look, we don't have a choice on this. We absolutely don't have a choice about whether to solve this. We have to solve this.
Så det här var alltså några röster från CNNs townhall-möte den 5 februari och de här fyra då. Men det är många fler som kommer att vara med och här följer en fortsatt analys om möjligheterna för alla kandidater i New Hampshire. Let's go to New Hampshire. What is the main difference between, a primary in New Hampshire and a caucus in Iowa?
So there's two really big differences. The first is a true structure, whereas a caucus involves, as was noted by our last conversation, people coming not just to go in a booth and tick a vote like is very common around the world, but rather sitting there in some cases for hours and certainly for an extended period of time. And also coming out to their neighbors and, raising their hands or being seen to be voting so there's no secret ballot. So those are two very, very big differences. But there's a third very important issue, and that is that whereas in Iowa, if you have to be a Democrat, a declared registered Democrat or Republican, to vote in either the Republican or Democratic caucuses, in New Hampshire you can walk in and even if you voted Republican in the last election, you can go vote in the Democratic election. This time it's what's known as an open primary. And because, unlike 2016, when both sides were competing actively, there will be no functional New Hampshire Republican primary. Obviously, there will be one, but no one cares because Donald Trump's going to get 80-90% of the vote, so it won't matter. You will have a lot of New Hampshire Republicans choosing to vote in the Democratic primary. Hmm. Now, if they do this scattershot, it will add probably tens of thousands of votes, which is interesting in and of itself, but it doesn't necessarily create any sort of expectation. However, if there is a concentrated movement by Republicans to do either support the Democrat that is most like a Republican, which would probably arguably be Joe Biden, or alternatively, to pick and support the most radical Democrat so as to strengthen Donald Trump's chances against someone who is seen to be unelectable, which someone would probably argue that's either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, from Republican logic standpoint, then you could definitely see, that candidate getting some false friends, as it were. But it would probably be worth, again, another 3, 4, 5 points. And it's very difficult to poll those people. So they kind of act, very interestingly as free agents. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. We don't have any polling on that. And it could very well be the basis of either Joe Biden's recovery, if they go the one direction, or it could also be the basis of a devastating, victory for Bernie Sanders, or a surprise victory for Elizabeth Warren. So
yeah,
they will definitely matter for sure. And it'll be interesting to see what they do. I think that's sort of the unspoken story in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Do you think there could be a coordination from like Trump or a local Republican party go to the Democratic primary and vote for this one?
I mean, there certainly won't be any formal operations by Donald Trump, but I can certainly see, local activists who do tend to, belong to Facebook groups and their friends and colleagues because of the nature of politics. I could definitely see some modest coordination happening, again, in which direction they choose to take it. Party officials tend to want the weakest candidate, so I would think that they would push voters to either Sanders or Warren, whereas there will be some true Republicans, but who are soft Republicans, more moderate Republicans, Republicans like Mitt Romney, frankly, who, they are Republican, but they don't support Donald Trump, and so they probably want to pick a Democrat that most reminds them of a moderate. And in those cases, I could see Joe Biden picking up quite a number of votes.
Yeah. Would you say that as an American and as a Republican strategist that, Bernie Sanders is way too left for the American public in general? In a matchup between Sanders and Trump, would Sanders lose? Is that like a fact?
Well, and that is the $64,000 question. The truth of the matter is, Bernie Sanders has one thing going for him that offsets a lot of his negatives. And it's very similar to Ron Paul and his support. Ron Paul had a surprising amount of goodwill among Democrats, despite being a very conservative Republican who certainly disagreed with the Democrats 9 times out of 10. And it was unquestioned personal integrity. And I do think that Bernie has that as well. Mm. While I disagree with him on philosophy and policy, the man's character seems to be above reproach, and by all appearances. And so there's an interesting fact that, when you look at moderates and when you look at people who are disillusioned with management in our country, Bernie Sanders speaks to them outside of his political philosophy. I would argue that Elizabeth Warren will verifiably get Donald Trump reelected, probably by 3 or 4 percentage points. It would be a slam dunk for Trump. Bernie creates problems for the Democrats, probably down ballot, but he himself is a very intriguing candidate. And in fact, he agrees with Donald Trump in certain ways. I mean, Bernie is known for being a pro-gun Democrat, for instance, yeah, which is quite rare these days. And so, again, even mainstream Democrats are further to Bernie's left on a few issues like that, and on issues like fair trade.
The gun question, let's talk a little bit more about that, because I read that just the other day, and I thought, like, what? Does Bernie Sanders support guns? And he does. Can you explain why?
Well, Bernie Sanders, like a number of principled liberals, believes that the Second Amendment protects us from true tyranny. And it's while it's an uncommon belief in the Democratic Party these days, it is one that, ironically, the far left tends to agree with mainstream Republicans on, because they believe that, in a fear of tyranny and a fear of invasion and things like this, they believe the Republicans are correct. And the NRA's gone so far as to publicly endorse Bernie Sanders for election on more than one occasion. So he's actually been NRA endorsed. And in fact, it's arguable that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump's positions on guns are virtually the same, if not with Bernie being, arguably in the past, at least slightly more pro-gun than Trump, ironically. So that's what I mean about Bernie Sanders being a truly untraditional opposition candidate. He has the ability. I don't expect him to do well in deep red states, and like flip Texas blue or something silly like that. But in places like New Hampshire and Iowa, which are purple states, put Colorado, I could see a situation where true independents who might lean Republican normally would give Bernie Sanders a second look, especially if they are particularly strong on like a pro-gun issue or if they support organized labor. And most people forget that 35% of all union members in America are registered Republicans. Hmm. And Donald Trump won them, as well as some Democrat union members, and I could see Bernie creating a real problem for Donald Trump there in states like Michigan and Wisconsin, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, states where he won or nearly won, that be able to flip. So it'll be interesting.
But yes, indeed, indeed. You know, we have some other smaller candidates that, you know, basically skipped Iowa, and they're only campaigning in New Hampshire, and that is Tulsi Gabbard, it's Michael Bennett, it's Deval Patrick, and to some extent also Andrew Yang, because he did not really do that well in Iowa. I think he became last or something like that. Do you think they have any chance in New Hampshire?
Well, Andrew Yang is probably the most interesting candidate in the sense that he, like Bernie Sanders, although on a much smaller level, has a very strong internet following and has the ability to raise tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars a week, you know, from people who, much like Ron Paul, believe in him more than they care about his ability to win at all. And so I suspect that Andrew Yang may wind up going the distance, whereas certainly I think Michael Bennett will drop out after New Hampshire. I think Tulsi Gabbard will probably do so as well, unless she has a surprising success, which she could, you know, Tulsi is in that position because she's polling, from what can be said, around that 5 or 6% mark. And she does have a bit of a Republican following. So it's possible that she could perhaps surprisingly finish, you know, 7, 8, 9%, which could potentially, you know, be in a fifth place or sixth place finish, which would be pretty credible and could see her stay in at least through South Carolina, which has a large veteran community. She, of course, is a decorated combat veteran herself. Okay. So, you know, again, you could expect her to do reasonably well as a second-tier candidate in South Carolina, again, getting 5, 6, 7, 8% of the vote. And in this way, she undermines Pete Buttigieg because he is the only top-tier candidate who's a military veteran. And she also undermines some of Joe Biden's vote as well. So ultimately, her being in the race benefits, Bernie Sanders the most. It also undermines Elizabeth Warren, again, the female vote. There are people who will take a look at her who won a female president, and they might have otherwise voted for Warren, you know, and they'll pull the trigger for Tulsi or Klobuchar, for that matter. So, you know, it is gonna add some vote takers. The victor may well have a voting percentage that is in the 20s rather than the 30s.
Yeah,
you know, in campaigns in the past.
Yeah, you know, tomorrow it's the 8th Democratic primary debate, and I think there are five candidates. Do you have any thoughts about the debate? Who needs to perform and who needs to, you know? Yeah, any comments?
Well, Tom Steyer's campaign is on the verge of irrelevance. He did stunningly poorly in Iowa. Andrew Yang got almost five times the votes of Tom Steyer, which is quite shocking, in my opinion. Yet he's still on the stage because of his spending for the donor thresholds and some of his broader national spending has made him punch above the Yangs and the Gabbards. But his campaign's on the verge of irrelevance. And if he doesn't have a real standout moment in the debate, and likewise at least a top six finish in New Hampshire, I don't see the point of him continuing. He certainly doesn't have the issue of not having money. He could spend another $100 million and still be fine personally. But at a certain point, if you're not getting any delegates, which he didn't in Iowa, you know, and he doesn't get any in New Hampshire, you know, even a gentleman like him will start to wonder why he's spending, you know, $5 or $10 million a week and achieving quite literally nothing.
Yeah. Any other candidates? You have any thoughts about anyone else?
I mean, I think that Mayor Pete has got to, you know, no pun intended, repeat his performance. I think he needs to certainly finish in the top three in New Hampshire, which looks certain, frankly. But really, I think he needs to finish in the top two. He's going to struggle in South Carolina if he doesn't, although the most recent polls indicate he's got about a 4-point bump in South Carolina, taking him from fifth place to fourth place in South Carolina. So he's moving in the right direction, and he still has a couple of weeks. So, you know, if he finishes in the top two or even a close pack three in New Hampshire, that could be worth another 3 or 4 points in South Carolina, which could bring him into the top three there. You know, Mayor Pete, like Sanders, is raising a staggering amount of money online, so he definitely has the ability to run through Super Tuesday effectively. And I expect Mayor Pete will do extraordinarily well in California, not least of which due to the gay vote, frankly. Yeah. And I expect him to win San Francisco. And that's pretty big since, as evidence, the current governor of California is the former mayor of San Francisco. So that's a good place to win. You know, but Mayor Pete has a complex pathway to the nomination. He's definitely got to continue to outperform expectations for the next few weeks, both in New Hampshire and South Carolina, for him to have a real shot at the nomination. But he did himself some good work in Iowa, and I would say his campaign is definitely robust and sincerely alive to fight for at least another month. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, final question. Do you have a favorite among the Democrats? And I don't mean politically, but, you know, as a person, who is the person you would like to, you know, spend time with among the Democratic candidates?
Well, I have a confession to make in that I have personally met Vice President Biden on more than one occasion.
Oh.
And I personally find him to be a truly decent, compassionate, and thoughtful person in his face-to-face communication. Now, obviously, I can't compare him apples to apples with all the other candidates, as I've only met a couple of them. But I will say that on a person-to-person level, as well as his nature as a husband and father, he exhibits exceptional personal character, which I respect, and has been a friend to a lot of people. He exhibits that character on the trail. That being said, obviously I have some political, philosophical disagreements with him, but I have to say I have a soft spot for Joe Biden. I also have to admit that I have found Mayor Pete to be an exceptionally talented communicator. My question, and it is a very difficult question, is how genuine he is. And I'm not saying that to say that he is false, but rather that I don't know. One of the difficulties of having someone like a mayor of a smaller city is that he hasn't really had to face the scrutiny of either a voting record in the Congress or management of major, you know, state or national issues. So, you know, it's easy for him to, you know, take a position that he's never had to face the voters on before and come up with a wonderful answer. But there's always the question of what he would do, frankly, under fire politically. And he just doesn't have the track record of experience. That gives me a lot of pause personally. I think it will give a lot of Americans pause. But he does seem to have just a very, very kind form of communication. Even when he's talking about difficult topics, he comes across as someone who, above everything else, is trying to be sincere in his communication. Maybe an act, who knows. But he's a very interesting candidate because of it. And I think that's probably why he won Iowa.
Yeah.
And why they continue to do well.
Yeah, if you have time, you know, I have one more question about Pete Buttigieg. He talks a lot about, you know, the American left and, you know, about Christianity. And he basically wants to, he wants to, you know, take back Christianity and patriotism from the Republican Party and offer it to the Democratic Party. And I think I find it very interesting because he is the only candidate that really tries to do that. But my question is, does the Democratic Party care about those issues any longer? Do they care about God or do they care about, you know, patriotism? Do they even care, the Democratic voters?
Well, and that is an exceptional question. And I would say, you know, that the answer is probably just as complex as the question itself. I would say that in certain states, you will find his approach to be well rewarded. I think in others, it won't matter as much. I think that, you know, the bigger divide we see on issues of things like spirituality in this country tends to be more of an urban versus rural divide than a Republican versus Democratic divide. You know, and Joe Manchin, who's the Democratic U.S. Senator from West Virginia, typifies this, right? I mean, I argue that Joe Manchin is further to the right than 10 Republican U.S. senators that are from places like New York City, or Massachusetts. You know, it's, you know, faith, it tends to be something that has a little more of a small town brand. And so I suspect Mayor Pete may wind up doing better than a lot of people in the Democratic primary in places like South Carolina and Alabama and Texas, where faith is a little more forward than it is perhaps in a California or New Jersey. And to the broader question, I would hope that God is so big that, you know, that no partisan wall keeps him from speaking to people in their lives and regardless of which church you attend. But what I will say is that, you know, obviously I might have some disagreements with his interpretations of faith as a conservative libertarian personally, but I do think that he speaks about it genuinely. I don't doubt that he is a personal believer, you know, based on his way of communication. Again, this could be an act, but it comes across as very sincere. And to be quite candid, when you contrast it with Donald Trump's comments about faith, which seem to be almost checking the box, as we'd say, you know, I would argue that perhaps Mayor Pete's faith is more genuine than President Trump's.
Yeah.
Ironic. And it does give him a bit of an open that he certainly wouldn't have had against a George W. Bush or a Mike Huckabee or a, you know, somebody, or even John McCain for that matter. So that's an issue.
But Pete Buttigieg would never say, like Barack Obama said, like they cling to the guns and religions. He would never say that.
Correct. And I do think that, you know, one of the benefits that some politicians forget, and certainly in a divisive country like we have right now, is being forgotten by many, is sometimes one of the best things you can do to achieve victory is to make the other side not hate you. Many people believe, you know, that one of the key components to Donald Trump's victory in 2016 was the absolute outrage that many people had towards Secretary Clinton and the fact that not so much they were voting for Donald Trump as against Hillary Clinton. And I do feel like Pete Buttigieg, unlike Elizabeth Warren, quite frankly, is one of those candidates who it's very difficult to hate him. You know, even if you disagree with him, he seems to carry himself as a man of decency and respect and underlying kindness to where it's, you know, if you're lobbing bricks at him, you kind of look like a jerk.
Yeah.
And again, given Donald Trump's campaign tactics, Mayor Buttigieg is an interesting, you know, foil because he's not likely to get down in the gutter with him, but rather to take the high road and look like it. And when it comes to Democratic primary voters, that may not matter that much, to be honest. But when it comes to winning a general election and all the 10 or 20% of Americans that don't believe in either party, that could be a real benefit.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, okay. Thanks a lot for taking time, Justin. Thank you.
Absolutely, Ronnie. You have a wonderful day.
Det var avsnitt 1023 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser med mig, Ronny Berggren. En podcast som jag driver ideellt i syfte att erbjuda de konservativa analyser av amerikansk politik som svensk media inte ger. Podden är gratis men stöd mottages tacksamt på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom att via hemsidan stödja på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Det var allt för idag. Tack för att ni har lyssnat. Not.